I'm Eunice Scarfe, and this session is the first of a series for this week on Mother May I relationships in fiction. Mother May I was quite arbitrarily chosen. I think it's a phrase all of you recognize, do you not, from sometime in childhood, that game we played, Mother May I, Can I Do It? I'm using it as a metaphor, as a suggestion for all the kinds of permission and refusals that family members have on each other. Mother May I goes beyond stories of mothers to authority figures, and may I what, we'll have to ask for each of the stories. The stories do not neatly and tidily fit into this and just perfectly. It was an umbrella under which 5 stories on relationships amongst family members could be looked at. We'll be looking at 1 story a day. The stories that are featured for this week, and they're listed on the board over there, are on Monday, Das Engelein kommt, which you saw in English over there, which is The Little Angel Comes. The second one is Homestead Crescent. The third one, Print Dresses. The fourth, Women's Day, by a woman called Gloria Ostrom Sawai, who has been at Holden in the past and is out of a tradition similar to many of yours, born in Minneapolis, raised in a Lutheran home, and writing now in Canada. And did I say Women's Day? This is Mother's Day. Maybe there's no difference. What do you think? Yes, there is. And on Friday, Ululik, which is a story up in the north of the starvation amongst the Inuit and an outsider coming in and seeing what is happening to that people. So I'm trying to do quite a large spread, and I'm going to go through it again and tell you a little bit more about each of them. On the first one, there is a German background. Here there's a Mennonite German background, German Lutheran background. Here's a German Mennonite background. Here's an Anglican English background. Here's a Norwegian Lutheran background. And here's an Inuit background with a Canadian from the south coming up to the north. So a second way of looking at these stories, in my opinion, is similar to something he mentioned in reference to Endo, that each of these homes, families, is also in a larger world. And that is a world in which a religion has functioned as a common denominator in the home. So if that interests you, we'll look at that as well. If it doesn't, we'll look primarily at families. There's a third way in which these are organized, and that is the writers of all 5 of them are Canadian writers. And please will you forgive my bias. I was born and brought up and educated in the States, and I think managed to get to the age of 24 without ever reading a piece of Canadian fiction, with the exception, perhaps, of Anne of Green Gables, who is Canadian, though it was not apparent to me when I read Anne of Green Gables that Prince Edward Island was a Canadian island, and that's my error as a reader. But I think that perhaps there was nothing I read. I did a master's degree in American literature without doing anything, even though we were looking at it historically, anything to do with the Canadian fiction. And just out of curiosity, I'm interested in how many of you could cite or name or have read recently or in the far distant past a Canadian fiction with the exclusion of Anne of Green Gables. We won't count her. Can I just see hands? I thought so, it's that bad. You too.
Yeah, surely you too.
So why do I take these 5? Not because I think it's my goal or right to attempt to focus on Canadian fiction, but I am in the process of doing a Master of Fine Arts in English creative writing program, and all of the literature I'm studying I have done by choice in Canadian fiction, since there's such a stunning gap in my own background, and I've been there 15 years and want to know the Canadian literature, and because I think that these are new stories for us. I can almost guarantee, and I think I was right, that very few of these would have come across your desk or through your library. These stories have been published in small magazines around in anthologies in Canada, and they all happen to be by contemporaries. In other words, the writers are still living. So how many ways are we looking at them? As families within a religious context, as Canadian writers, 4 out of the 5 are women. The last one is a Rudy Weed. And they're all living, contemporary. So there you have the plan for the week. There are a few substitutions possible, but I think we're going to stick with this. In addition, I'm just going to point out the way in which the families function in the stories. This is daughter and parent, and one of the things I'll be asking when I read the story is to look for how that has been dramatized. The parent, which child is being focused here. The daughter's relation to the past here, a granddaughter's relation to something she has inherited. The world of a child here, a most marvelous recreation of a child's voice in the story, which is extremely difficult to do. And I think you'll agree with me when we start that on Thursday. And the last one, an outsider to the Inuit family. Someone who knows the family before the starvation began, the person who goes in to attempt to rescue them and watches what's happened within a family relationship, a family group. And if you know a little bit about Inuit culture, you might have some speculation as to what he finds when he arrives, the narrator. All right. In addition, I was going to say one more thing about Canadian writing, that this is all Western Canadian writing. Almost exclusively, this is Saskatchewan, Alberta, a little bit of British Columbia. In Canada, we're bilingual, and it is somewhat biased on my part to have all Western, because it leaves the impression there's all English-speaking fiction up there. We are a bilingual country. My children learned to read in French before English. The French Canadians publish and write in French. And we have two languages, two literatures, and in a sense, two cultures. The most famous book, novel, written about the two cultures was called Two Solitudes, a quote from Rilke. And it was in relation to the fact that in Canada, there was the French Canada in the East, and the English-speaking Canada, well, not entirely English-speaking, but English was imposed on it by the British. You have the German, Ukrainian, so on, Central European, as you can see in this title even. But those two cultures and literatures exist side by side. So with my apologies to French Canada, when I say this is Canadian fiction, it's the English-speaking Canadian fiction. I want to give you one example from the past of Canadian fiction. I'm going to talk a little bit in general about this. Margaret Atwood, who you may know as the writer of Handmaid's Tale, which is beginning to appear, I think, on the bestseller list in the States, or has been featured down here, Handmaid's Tale, a recent book, and it's a futuristic novel, almost a 1984, an excellent novel, predicting, projecting a possible society if certain trends continue, and it's set in the States. She was educated at Radcliffe for one of her degrees and has returned to that location for the site of this novel. That's Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood. She has perhaps written the most comprehensive survey of Canadian fiction up to now, and she calls it survival. And she points out that in British fiction, and I hope I'm not doing a disservice to her ideas, we have a major image of the land or of nature, which is the garden. And the story is set in the garden or exploiting the garden. The nature is tame. The nature has been planned and for our purposes. And it is tameable. There's no battle in getting the gardens to grow in English fiction. And this is as a metaphor for what the people face in facing the environment in which they function. In the States, she sees as the metaphor for nature, the frontier, and the conquering of the hero by the frontier. Now, this is simplifying in some ways, but it's a dominant image in the literature of a people. In Canada, what is the image for nature? She suggests that the image is the wilderness, which cannot be conquered, as in the States, or in American literature, or tamed, as in British literature. But the metaphor she sees most dominant is that the nature and all of its harsh effects destroy the individual, and that survival is a major theme of a great deal of Canadian literature in the early days. And hence the title of her book, Survival. Now that's oversimplifying, but it's a theme that she develops throughout. How it's influenced, how the experience of the people in the natural world in which they live. And survival in Canada was a major, major feat for the early settlers, and there are parts of the States who experience the same kind of harshness, and I think you're familiar with those parts. One of these stories which would fit her image, which is a famous Canadian story, is called The Painted Door. And I'll briefly go through it to just illustrate to you how she's using this notion. A woman in a homestead shack is left alone, and her husband goes for wood several miles across the land. And you've all perhaps inherited stories or read stories of those who were left alone while provisions were got or while someone went out for wood or whatever was necessary. She's left alone. She has no children. A blizzard sets in, and a close neighbor calls in on her and says that her husband passed through his place on the way to the village or the town, and he spends the night. He says the man will not be coming back. He's dead already. He's a lone man, and he says she will be a widow before morning. It's the most severe blizzard of the decade, and it's described in graphic detail. Before the neighbor arrives, and although she argues with him, by late evening she knows if he isn't back, he's dead. There's no way you could live in this. Before the arrival of the visitor, she's been painting the door to their shack. And the story is one with a twist. In that the neighbor spends the night, they have virtually buried after this 10 hours of sitting through the blizzard, he can't return either. And in the morning, she dreams that her husband returns. In the morning, he's not returned, and she knows that he's dead. There's no shelter possible on the prairie. And as she goes out in the morning to the barn, she finds his body, and on his hand is the white paint from the doorway. And if any of you were here for the... So he's been there, and the dream was not a dream. If any of you were here for the skating party, it's almost as tight a story as that one in terms of its ending. That's perhaps the example most familiarly used for the notion of survival, man against the elements, and that the survival is not 50-50. It's usually the odds are greater towards not surviving. And the early literature featured this in a wide variety of ways. All right, enough on the culture out of which we're choosing these passages. Last week we looked at writing from a writer's point of view. We looked at beginnings, how to start out beginning. And if you were here last week, I asked you to get out paper and pen, and we started working immediately. How to write beginnings, how to write endings. In the middle, the narrator. Who do you choose to be a narrator? And what role, what voice does a narrator speak in? We talked about truth in fiction, what kind of truth is appropriate to fiction, the truth within a fictional story, and the corresponding truth to the world in which we live. How does it correspond, if at all? And lastly, we talked about a phrase, you don't say, meaning you don't say in fiction, you show, make them see, make the reader see. And some of those elements, beginnings, the endings, the narrator, how to show what you're talking about as opposed to just say it, we're going to talk about as we go through the stories this week, because I'm not only interested that we look at stories for in any of the ways we've listed, but that potential writers, or those of you who are interested in writing, see the problems which writers face as they approach a piece of fiction. And much of the commentary I'm going to do is, what kind of problem does a writer have here? How is it solved? Which perhaps is slightly different than the way we normally look at fiction. I am a writer, and I'll say in a minute what kind of writing I'm doing, and that is a question of primary importance to me. All right. One of the things I'm going to talk about just briefly is, what does a writer do? We've talked about problems a writer has. What does a writer do? And I want to suggest half a dozen things to you. And I think before I run through my list, what do you ask of a writer? I would like to throw out the question. What do you ask of the writer who is writing the fiction that you read? What do you expect? What does that writer, what must that writer do for you? Any stabs at an answer to that for many of you? Gives me some idea of what kind of fiction you're reading. What do you require of the writer whose works you read? Yes.
Well, moderate length, or, you know, something that doesn't take like a year to finish, like, let's say, Hawaii or Michener's works.
You drop those? Drop those? Those are too long?
Yeah.
How long is too long? Okay, Hawaii is too long. Michener's too long. War and Peace, we have to get rid of War and Peace then. What else do we have to get rid of? Maybe Shakespeare, if it takes you a while to get through it, given the language. Yes. Okay, length is a criteria for you. Is that a letter for starting English, or is that?
Yeah, 5 minutes long.
Cool. Is that a bell?
No.
Well, anyway, we're on our way. I thought that was to start. Yeah.
I know some writers write focusing on character, others write focusing on plot. I guess I like a combination. I find that I miss something if I get to know the people without the action, without moving me along. I can get bored with just character focus. And on the other hand, if it's all action and I don't get to know the characters, I don't care enough about them. I like a combination.
Okay, can you give an example of one that meets your criteria? Should we give you a minute? Come back to.
I just brought with me a book. When I read trash novels, I read spy novels, but Le Carré writes with characters that are more than just automatically making decisions. They live in a real world, and that's a good example of in that genre of what I like.
Okay, there's quite a bit of texture there. There's more than just a character serving the writer's ends.
Right.
In those, right? The car he's mentioning, Drummer's Girl, is that the
one? Yeah, that's what I wrote with.
Yeah, another?
I like a reader that tells me something about myself in the process. Usually through character descriptions, but I can find myself in the novel and maybe people that I know.
Okay, so some sense of a mirror is set up. And can you give an example of one that would has done that for you?
Wendell Berry.
Okay. Wendell Berry, I'm not familiar with the novels. Can you name one?
Memory of Old Jack, Nathan Coulter, teaches English at University of Kentucky.
Oh, Wendell Berry, so a Southern writer.
B-E-R-R-Y.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Actually, I think if it's a Southern writer, I think it's just been on the list handed to me. That, is he recent? Is he contemporary writing now?
This Old Jack is new, but he goes back about 20 years.
But the writer is living.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Wendell Berry. Others that would fit that criteria, ones that reflect to you of either yourself or a world in which you live, or give language for a world that you have lived or experiences you have lived.
Well, what I was thinking of here, Willa Cather's The Song of the Lark is one of my favorites, but I suppose I see myself a little bit in Thea Kronberg, but I was thinking another feature that I really like of Willa Cather's works is landscape, mm-hmm. the way she mm-hmm. depicts the Southwest so well.
Okay, Song of the Lark is in the Southwest, isn't it? Arizona.
Well, yeah, and it's also in New York, too. I mean, mm-hmm. Thea Kronberg starts in Colorado and then goes east.
I'm glad you mentioned Cather, because if you know Cather, I think early part of the 20th century, she was one of the first to, what should we say, write both place and people. And by place, I mean the Midwest at the time. Nebraska was her home. And the location she first, I think, really evoked most thoroughly as a writer coming into her own in My Antonia. And also the people there. The notion of the conflict between the different immigrants coming, first and second generation. And I mention her with some emphasis because this was done in the early part of the 20th century for Nebraska. It's been done in the last generation in Canada. Vertically, they're the same part of the states in terms of migration across the country. And the one that's similar, not the same, but similar, is Margaret Lawrence writing in Manitoba, who I think is one of our major novelists who may, in fact, have crossed the border. There is some dreadful barrier at the border for fiction that don't seem to slide through the novels, the text, or the writers. Margaret Lawrence, I would mention in the same breath as Willa Cather, who has, through two novels, and these I would recommend if you are writing down ones to read, The Stone Angel, in which she takes Hagar, and the Old Testament name is chosen very deliberately. Hagar is an old woman looking back on her life, reflecting, with a very sharp tongue and some very pointed memories, still living with her children. They're considering a home for her, and in the process she recreates her whole life. And on the hill in this small town is a stone angel in the cemetery, and she has more than one glance at that stone angel, which becomes a metaphor for her of her life and of the town's life. Recreates the first and second generation in similar ways to what Cather does in My Antonia in Nebraska. This was published probably in the early 60s. Margaret Lawrence's other book that I'd like to recommend, and I really think she's the grand old woman of Canadian letters for contemporary, for this generation, is A Bird in the House, a collection of short stories we call the Vanessa short stories, all set in a small town that she's made up. I get mixed up with where she really lives and what she's made up. Nipawa is where she really lives. Manawanka, thank you, is the fictional town. And the stories are all connected because Vanessa is in them. It's thinly disguised autobiography. They are fully created short stories in which she's taken liberties as a writer must with material she knows, creating it into short stories, and the evocation of a child growing up in the town, her parents, pillars of the community, Scottish-Irish ancestry. Lawrence, I would say, is a kindred spirit to what Cather has done in her writing and did in her writing. Any other requirements from you from what a writer must do? We'll find out at the end of the week if what you want from a writer has happened in any of the writers we read this week. I'm going to run briefly through my list of what a writer does or can do, which is perhaps slightly more theoretical, but nevertheless I think applies to what each of us finds in writing. One of the things I think I would suggest a writer does is pose the question, ask the question, raise the question. When I say the question, I don't mean a specific question. I mean saying what if, or why not, or was this how it was? And you can get more philosophical about that, but raise a question, which is quite different than a story being a vehicle for giving the answer, holding a question in suspension. Is it like this? Was it like this? And also, could it be like this? Which is a vision, is it not? Could not this be? The most probably early example I had of vision in fiction was J.D. Salinger's creation of the Glass Family. And to me, he'd created the ideal siblings. They were whiz kids. Did any of you read Salinger? This is definitely 60s stuff. And the Glass Family, the bright
Catcher
whiz kids,
Rye.
Catcher in the Rye. Okay, it's beyond Catcher in the Rye that I'm thinking of. The Glass Family. And he creates a bunch of kids that were on a whiz kid program every Saturday morning. They're siblings. There's Zoe and Franny and, oh, who else? All with very peculiar names. But their relationships with each other were innovative and curious, and they were bright, too bright for the real world. They stuck together as a tribe. And you felt as if he'd created the family in which he wanted to live. It was so powerfully evoked that this was a vision of the way in which human beings could relate to each other. That happens in many of our novels. Posing the question, could it be like this, or why isn't it like this? Secondly, I suggest a writer, in terms of their own work, is silencing the words. And there's been two images given that I've heard from writers recently. One was Wangren last week saying you inhale from around you and you exhale a description or a words for what has happened. That we are all experiencing something here. We are all experiencing our lives. It's the writer who finds words to describe that. To experience the world, we all do. To express the world is done by what? Writers and other artists, not just writers. I sometimes see a writer like a sponge who is just soaking and soaking in until the words are so many. One of the poets has said, I write in order to silence the words. Get rid of all the water in the sponge, all the words, all the storylines, and then start again. And if you're interested in vision, the notion of a vision that a writer has of how it ought to be, which I've mentioned briefly, John Gardner has got two superb texts on the notion of what a writer does with vision in the fiction in which he writes. All right, some of the notions for what we expect. So we're looking here at a writer's imposing order, creating worlds. You are going to think some of these sound like autobiography, and I don't deny that some of them sound as if they're created right out of their past, a slice of a period of time. But I would like to suggest to you, to be fair to the writers, which is sometimes difficult, even for writers, they look on other works and say, oh, this is obviously just recreated a narration. There is always the imposition of order, the recreation of experience, the pattern imposed in order to make that work of art. And a short story is a very, very condensed work of art. A novel can ramble, a short story, everything has to be deliberately in there. It's like the condensed orange juice in the novel is when you've added all the water. The short story has nothing accidental in it, if it's working. I would like to make one aside on this notion of give the writer the benefit of being a fictional character as a narrator. When you hear I in a story, is the I, and you will hear an I in this story today, the writer, the author, himself or herself? If you hear I today in Gertrude Story's story, her last name is Story, in Gertrude Story's story, spoken as I, is that Gertrude talking to you?
Not usually.
No. If it's a story, if it's a piece of fiction, Gertrude is not talking. Who is talking?
Yeah.
The narrator. We use the word narrator. Yeah. Is almost the most useful word for this. The narrator is talking. It sounds like Gertrude because by the end of the story, you are familiar with this first-person writer. It's not Gertrude. You can look at Gertrude's autobiography and discover that she grew up in a German Lutheran environment. She did come from a farm. And perhaps the period of time she's writing about coincides with her life. But she is imagining. Is it possible for the author to imagine to be her mother? Now, let's say we look at here are the characters in the story today. Mama, Papa, Elsa, the narrator, Floydie, the son. If that's the family, similar to a family in which she grew up in or saw, can she imagine to be her aunt or her mother or a niece that didn't exist? Of course she can. And we do a disservice to say the facts of this family look pretty close to Gertrude Story's real life. It's obviously her talking. I have a terrible story about Color Purple, and it's terrible because somebody whose intelligence I respected said to me, after we'd studied a passage on Alice Walker talking about how she'd written Color Purple, she has a 3-page account of where the voice came from, voices came from. This person said to me, how many of you read Color Purple or seen the film? Oh, good. Okay. There is black speech, they are not dialect, a dialect. And Seeley's voice is marvelously recreated in literature for having dialect and having the grammatical expression. Beautifully done. And it's readable. So often dialect becomes unreadable. the amazing thing with what Walt has done is that it's readable. And after I presented this passage, we're talking about the process by which writers write, and so we looked at Walker's essay, how she wrote Color Purple. And he came up afterwards and he said, I had no idea she was such an educated woman. I mean, the speech in Color Purple.
Oh.
Yes. It's a horrible story, isn't it? Because this man should know better. He had assumed that because the writer chose to write in dialect, illiterate, uneducated speech, however we talk about this, non-standard English, which is not in any way lower standard, it's non-standard, that was her speech. A writer's first task is to make real a created speech or world, whatever, and grant, give the benefit of the doubt that this has happened. His first assumption that with Alice Walker couldn't write, I can't believe it, I still can't believe it. That's my worst story.
It takes intelligence to make you believe that person.
Yes, it was a credit to Alice Walker that he had.
Compliment
to her. I once wrote a story set in Minnesota, and a writer said to me later in conversation, how long did you live in Minnesota? And I burst out laughing, and then he remembered where he'd gotten the information, because I had not lived in Minnesota, well, a period of college, but not resident there. Because he had to think back. He'd identified the story with me and had to think back that came from the story and not from my life. I did the same thing to him once, and he has a novel, or to another writer. This other writer has a novel in which a coal mine is featured. They have a banquet in a coal mine, similar to this big football field up there that you could imagine using as a cavernous banquet hall. And I said, he has a farm in the country, and I said, where is the mine? There is no mine on the property. But because it had shown up in all, you start mixing things like this up. But you make a decision that you grant the writer the right to imagine and invent, and you will use a strand out of the 50 you're weaving from the world you know. And you might use an event out of the 50 pieces that go into a story. One piece might be an event. But that we grant the right of a fictional world. I'm going to tell you one more story about this. When I was 16, I wrote a piece of writing in answer to a competition sponsored by the Lutheran Church. What were they then? TALC, American Lutheran Church, for the Miami Beach Convention. Some of you went or remember or sent your children or were there, 1961. I wrote a piece. They were going to have a writing competition. And I won first prize, which immediately, in my great degree of humility, made me know that nobody else had entered the contest. It was a $50 prize. I was terribly proud. I went to the convention and they said I could read one evening, or would I read the piece one evening? Well, I'd read about writers. I mean, this was obviously instant fame and success. I won and I got to read, and there was like 12,000 people there, and it was a big night. Well, this is fine. And then they invited me to send it into the youth magazine to have it published, and I did. And they wrote a letter back saying, we're not going to publish your name. We're just going to publish the piece. Do you mind? And I was still trying to be humble, and I thought, I shouldn't mind if they don't put my name in. But then I looked at their reason, and the reason was that I had written first person a very unsavory character. And they were worried, they were protecting me from I don't ever know how to interpret this, either their ignorance that I was not the person I was pretending to be, or the readers would not be able to distinguish that this was fiction, but that my life and character and future might be ruined by my name being put there. I had a good English teacher, and I knew that you imagine the role you write in. And I never wrote back, and they published it without my name. But it left a question in my mind. As a writer, and this is the only experience at that age, you write for readers you hope can read. And not being able to distinguish between first person imaginary and first person literally is a fairly major necessity to be called a reader, is it not? There's something else awful that happened, and then I'll get on. These are all awful stories, they're not really awful. I went to college, and the first year I was at college, this was 3 or 4 years later, somebody stood up and read this piece for chapel. And by this time I disowned it. I put a real tidy point on this story, and I no longer believed in having a point. Like Weingarten said, it's like a bloodsucker at the end of a story, sucking out the blood of a story if it's written in order to have a point. I had a major point. The whole story existed for the sake of the great big bang ending. In case they didn't see it, I told the reader what was coming at the beginning and at the end, and then in case, I probably nudged it and summarized it at the end. I had no subtlety whatsoever. And somebody read it, and I was sitting in the room, and I thought, this is what happens when you write. You know, you live with it forever. It's in print. There I was, and I couldn't take the words back, and I didn't want to identify myself anyway. I would have stood up and said, that's no longer true, or don't pay any attention to that, or there it was. Those two things made an enormous impression on me. I went in another direction and thought to be a critic was superior to being a writer, and tried not to write for years and years until coming back to it in the last 5 years. But two experiences in which the first one, the identity was confused. You are who you pretend to be, which is not the case. And secondly, the writer having to own what they write for the rest of their life and not ever being able to take a word back was pretty scary to discover in such a dramatic way. All right. The stories then for today, for this week, I'd like to look at for pleasure. Hopefully they'll produce pleasure for you. A little bit looking at how a writer solves problems, some commentary on that. And lastly, I'd like to invite each of you at the end of the stories and at the end of our discussion, and I hope we will have some discussion on these, is that if you have some writing which you have always wanted to do or which this story gives a nudge to, I think if we don't finish in time on a given day, see me afterwards, because I have a suggestion for every day. You know, if you say, that reminds me of, or I'd really like to write something after having done that story. If there's time, I'll go through it with all of you. And you can give it to me anytime. I'd be happy to go through it, make some marks, and give it back to you. We won't be doing writing workshop as we did last week when we read them together. But at the end of every story, so we're doing two things. We're reading and writing this week, and the writing is optional and only of interest. I know you're on holiday. All right, so let's look at the story for today. The characters in the story, Mama and Papa, and Mama is a Schroeder. In the States, you listen to Prairie Home Companion on Saturday, don't you? I see all of America at the radio when I know it's Saturday. We don't get it in Canada. At least I can't get it. And from what I hear, I imagine you all by your radios, much like you would have been in 1930 when you didn't have television. This may not be the case. But, oh good, there's one exception at least. But I imagine everybody at their radio, you know, in a farm kitchen even. It's such a nice image of a state. And in Canada, we're listening to CBC Anthology. And that story is from the writers sent in to CBC. And they're featured Saturday afternoon or Saturday evening. And we listen for 30 minutes to a piece of fiction. This is one that was on Anthology. So it's hard sometimes when you're hearing a story to get the characters and what's happening, which is why I'm just identifying them here. There's a mama and a papa. A Schroeder is the mother, and Schroeder is mentioned at one point. She's the Schroeder, but their name is his now, which is not given. Elsa is the child about whom this story is written, the angel. There's the narrator, whose name we never know, and who is not, we've all agreed, Gertrude Story, the author. And Floyd, the younger brother. There's Elmira Bittner, who's mentioned two or three times, and who is not insignificant. There's the pastor, who has no name, but shows up in passing. And there's the white stallion that we may or may not be able to call a character, but the story wouldn't have happened without the white stallion. While we go through, I'd like you to look for these things, and I hope this doesn't sound this much like an English class. When we get over it, the discussion won't sound like an English class, will it? I'd like you to look for the hints that the writer gives for where and when this takes place. Every writer has to work into the story, weave into the story, where this takes place and when. Does it have to be obvious? In 1907, on a farm in this place? No. The hints are sometimes elusive. If you find the main character driving horses to town, it may not be in the present. It most likely is not in the present. That kind of subtle clue. Every writer is weaving these in, and sometimes with a great degree of subtlety. So please look for the setting. The narrator, give us look for how old she is now when she's telling the story, which is quite different to how old she was when the story took place. And a writer has a trick there to play. Are you going to write in the voice of the character, the narrator now, or is the voice going to be the voice of a narrator then, which is a young child? In this story, the narrator is going to be the voice of a child, probably 11. And it never varies from an 11-year-old, and it's a great trick to carry it off. And this one moves back and forth between now and then. And listen, for who is she writing as now, which is an adult, or then as a child? How does she work that tension out? And it's a very interesting balance. It keeps going in the story between those two. And then we talked a bit about last week about show and tell. Do you tell me somebody's angry if you're a writer, or do you show me? And I want to give you an example. On 56, this writer does not say Papa was angry, and watch for this when it comes in the story. Never does the writer say that Papa was angry. But if you read the following, tell me, is it not true that he is angry? Papa turned quick to the door and stepped on the paper bag with the costumes in it. I guess I should not have left it there. And he kicked at the bag, and it split, and the costume got tangled in his church overshoes, and he grabbed it and threw it in the corner. Is there any doubt? I don't think so. But notice she never used the word anger. One of the best examples, she's quite good, and watch carefully, because sometimes she's adding up details that aren't so obvious, this writer. You might ask, why does a story have to be told now? Why now? And look all the way through for the way in which she reveals a father-daughter relationship, because what we're looking at is families, are we not? Now, I'm going to read it. Do you need to cough or shuffle or get yourself comfortable? And you need to be warned that every day this week there'll be a story reading. And this is really customary to some of us and quite unusual to the others of us. Ingrid and I discovered last week when we announced story time for Christmas, two children showed up and 20 adults, which we thought was the reverse of the proportions you'd expect. 20 kids would come for a story and two adults.
Do you know when this class ends?
Quarter to? I think we're just kind of attending. I guess if the bell rings, you have a right to go, but if you want to know what happens, you'll have to stay. I'm sorry. I've tried to plan just so we'll finish at the... Oh, dear, No, I didn't, Ingrid.
Quarter to,
okay. We should be all right, even with discussion. When my sister Elsa was a baby, she was an angel, and my father called her Das Engelein. At our house, people never spoke in German. My mother would not allow it. Only my father ever did, and immediately she contradicts herself. Never spoke of German, but Dad. And we children could hardly understand him. It was the fury of his life having non-German children, one of the furies. He had several. The Brotherhood of Man was another. My father loved the Brotherhood of Man with an ardent, vocal passion. He loved his daughters too, I suppose, but they never knew it. He loved his son, and his daughters knew it. And I think those two sentences, if you read those at the beginning of the story, you know you've got a writer who could write. He loved his daughters, I suppose, but they never knew it. He loved his son, and his daughters knew it. He loved him like Isaac loved his Jacob, or like Abraham his Isaac. My father never sacrificed his Floydie on any altar, never even tried to, but he killed his daughters 1,000 times over. And this is to be the story of the last time he killed my sister Elsa in her snow-white Engelein gown, her wings spread and ready to soar at the church Christmas concert one year in the sandy, dry, hard farming district where we used to live. It had to be in German. The whole church concert had to be in German. Some of the kids did okay. They had mothers who hardly spoke English. The mothers stayed home and plucked geese and made quilts and pierogies and babies and crooned them to sleep with Komm Herr Jesu and sent them there with a few slaps to the ear if the child went unwilling. So it was at our house, too, except for the German and the Jesu. My mother didn't believe in either one. She had had it different at home. Her father was just as German as anybody else in that settlement, but his mind had a different order. His daughter was to go to normal school and be a teacher, but she chose Papa instead. No wonder, I suppose. Papa was tall and beautiful and imposing, and he courted every woman in the district atop his large white stallion, taking them for rides into the hills to show them the wood violets. I think the violets stopped when my mother agreed to come into his kitchen, but his passions did not. At least I knew we had violin and lots of talk and booming laughter when the neighbors came, but cold lips and steel blue eyes when they left again. It was a hard life in a lot of ways, but this is not that story. I tell it to you this way, though, because it is very hard at 50 to keep it going well, to keep the order. I've had too many other voices inside my head for so long, and Papa bellowing from his bed after Mama died, and the third white stallion through him. I want to tell you about Elsa. I think that is what she means to do when she comes now and stands by my side when I'm writing away the blackness and drinking the coffee Papa forbade in this house. She has been dead 41 years now. I counted it out today, and I suppose she has forgotten how to speak, on account of not knowing the sacred language up there. Papa used to say it was all in German up there, the German pastor once told him. All those years I thought it was an accident, and I'm sure Papa did too, but I think Mama knew. I do not want to do the thinking sometimes. There is a danger in it. But I think now Mama knew because it raised a real uproar the way she went to bed and stayed there the day it happened and wouldn't get up for the funeral. But that's ahead of it again. I need the order. It is harder than to have it in your head and know it, the setting of it down. Once I wanted to be a writer and I read King Arthur over and over until I knew the order of telling things, but now I cannot keep it straight. It goes like this, though. We always went to church. And watch, she contradicts herself again. Same with the dream. All but our mother. Papa said we had to go to church and learn the glory. It was not safe to live in this world otherwise. And the glory was only good if it came in German. It was the holy way. It was important because it had to do with Christus and the angels and your holy German soul. The words you spoke in the old tongue, he said, helped to get you the glory. That pastor, I knew him, said so, and Papa believed him, but our mother didn't. She said it was a peasant's attitude, and it was either all true in any language, or it was not all true, and maybe none of it true. And so what? It didn't put bread on the table. But you couldn't break it up into German and English and French. It wasn't logical. And Papa said what was logical was if she would allow his daughters to speak German at the supper table. But the Schroeders seemed to be such English bootlickers. It seemed to be more than the man could expect to have the same old tongue spoken around his own fireside. And our mother said, seemed to her it was Schroeder money bought the coal to keep the fire going. And Papa said, yes, yes, rub it in. And he took his box full of blue socialist tracts and saddled his white stallion with the red wild eyes and rode to Elmira Bittner's to discuss the Brotherhood of Man. And Mama would scrub hard at the fading red apples on the oilcloth on the table and make mouths at the way the girls' corners were wearing through, and she'd say, come on, girls, we'll make brown sugar fudge tonight. And our mother made brown sugar fudge with butter and walnuts. Most nights he did that. And sometimes when my sister Elsa peered too long into the night from the kitchen window, straining to see his white stallion coming back out of the dark night, my mother would say, don't be silly, girl. Do you think a bear would get him or something? He's only gone to get educated. Come on, we'll make ourselves some popcorn. But she didn't. She just turned her back on her mother and went and rearranged Papa's pipes neatly beside the family picture taken when there was only Papa and our mother and Elsa and me. And while Elsa looked at herself being an Engelein in the family picture, or angel as Papa called her, our mother and I would pop popcorn, shelling it first plink-plank into a pan on the cob and heating the heavy frying pan. Not Floydie, though. Floydie was a boy, and he was young and fast asleep. But Elsa would only pick away at her bowlful, and Mama would say, eat up, it's the way you like it. But Elsa would get that tight look around her eyes and say, no, I'm saving it for Floydie. And Mama would say, he's spoiled enough. And Elsa would say, you don't like anybody, do you? And she'd go back to the window and look some more for Papa and his stallion. And she only left her place at the window when Floydie cried, and then she always ran to him before Mama could go. And yet Floydie was the reason. I don't care. Why Elsa had to look out into the dark night for Papa with her pink barn goose eyes that got teary from too much watching. And Floydie was the reason Grandpa Schroeder got so mad with what we didn't get. He kept giving our mother money, we meaning the girls, to buy us girls new dresses for the school picnic and the church concert. Floydie was Papa's sunny boy cereal, and Elsa used to be his Engelein baby. But now she was just a girl who had grown a long Schroeder neck and couldn't do arithmetic. She couldn't learn a German piece either. For the church Christmas concert, you had to learn to speak a piece in German, no matter what. You had to, or your folks were shamed forever. Even my mother went to the church Christmas concert. It was holy, and not even the littlest ones expected to see Santa. And that year, that last year, Elsa said she wanted to be an angel. An angel in German, yet, and with 28 lines to speak. When Pastor asked who would take the part, Elsa's hand shot up, and it surprised me. Elsa was not that way. She would rather not speak even in English, and to do anything in German killed her. Especially speaking to Papa. When you have been an Engelein as a baby, and you aren't Papa's Engelein any longer, to stand before Papa and say, Ihr Kinderlein kommt, zur Bethlehem Stall, into his pale ice eyes doesn't help to make the wings grow. And if you are the one to have the wings clipped, you know this is the right order to say it. Kinderlein, not Kidderlein, Papa told her. Bethlehem, not Bethlehem. What do you want to put a thought in it for? People will think you're not raised right. Now start the first verse again, he would say. Elsa cared too much. It was dangerous. Day by day, she sewed on her Engelein costume, looking quite often at the picture on the sideboard. She sewed in the parlor, and once Mama caught her sewing by the kitchen lamp, the oil lamp, its flame flickering pale and yellow. Silly goose, Mama told her, it's too hard on the eyes. I could do it on the machine for you. But Elsa turned her back on Mama and said, I want to do it. And she'd show Papa after supper how it was coming, and he'd say, yes, yes, but you're not going to spend your life in a dress factory. How's your piece coming? And Elsa would stand there and speak, one angel wing drooping. And Papa would look up and say, put the Z in it. How come you can't remember? People will think you aren't raised right. And then he'd call Floydie for a game of clap handies. And Mama would say from the parlor door, come work in the kitchen, the light's better. But Elsa would stay near him. And on the Tannenbaum night, she spoke it pretty well, so I don't know why Papa had to do it. The candles were lit in the church, and you could almost smell the glory. And people shook hands with everybody they could reach, even after they got sitting down in the pews. The fat ones straining hard over their chest to shake hands with the one sitting behind them. And they call that gracing each other. We say giving the peace, but it's gracing each other. Grown-ups even shook hands with two-year-olds and graced each other, Freudig of Einox, whether they were mad at each other or not. And you could smell the mandarin oranges from the brown paper bags, each bag packed with two man's hands full of peanuts and almonds and striped Christmas candy made into curlicues, each one with two new oranges at the bottom. Oh, the Germans were never stingy when it was nuts and candy and they had the money. Only we were never allowed to open our bags until we got home. In our family, we were never allowed. That was Papa's way. You weren't supposed to look anxious. It meant you weren't raised right. But that night, we girls were wearing our new dresses Grandpa Schroeder had given the money for. And Floydie looked like a prince, true enough, Papa said, in his royal blue breeches and snow-white shirt with the ruffles. And Mama looked nice and came along to the concert. And people graced her, too. And only a few made remarks like, well, at least we see you at Christmas. So it was all good, very good, for once. And Elsa spoke right up, Ihr Kinderlein kommt, only with not enough Z's and N's in it. But she spoke clear and good, her eyes shining and her hands folded, and looking up into the candelabra so that her eyes got to be two candles, too. But the trouble was, her one wing drooped because she would not let Mama help her sew. And Mrs. Elmira Bittner said afterwards to Papa, now, Floydie, you tell that wife of yours I got time on my hands. I could help her next Christmas with the kids' costumes if she wants. Won't have so many drooping angel wings. And Mama was standing right there beside Mrs. Bittner. And Mrs. Elmira Bittner turned to her next and graced her and maybe even knew her. Mama hardly ever came to church, but Mama said later she did know who she was. And Papa said it didn't matter. Why worry about a little thing like Mrs. Bittner saying that? The point was, people thought his kids weren't raised right. How come she let the kids show up with a costume like that? It wasn't the first time either. We were on the way home, and the horses' hooves sounded crisp crunch on the hard-packed snow of the road, and the traces jingled like bells, although Papa wasn't the one to put brass bells on the harness. He said it was frippery. And I tried to think about the oranges, how they'd be when we got home and Papa let us open our bags. I had to think about the oranges, hard about the oranges. To think about Elsa's drooping wings was very dangerous. But when we got home, and Papa had carried Floydie inside, and us girls and Mama had our coats off, Elsa wouldn't even open her bag. And Mama was undressing Floydie, fast asleep on the kitchen table. And Mama had one eye on Elsa sitting silent on a hard chair by the Quebec heater with her piece still in her hand, her words. And Mama looked real nice, very nice. She hardly ever dressed up. And Papa came up behind her, his fur coat and hat still on, because he still had to go out and do the horses. And he laid his hand on Mama's shoulder and said, "It's always better after church." And he showed his hard, white, even teeth under his silky, smooth mustache. He was a very good looker, always. And Mama just picked Floydie up and walked out from under his hand and said over her shoulder, "Elmira Bittner has lots of time on her hands, I hear." And Papa turned quick to the door and stepped on the paper bag with the costumes in it. I guess I should not have left it there. And he kicked at the bag and it split, and the Engelon costume got tangled in his church overshoes, and he grabbed it and threw it in the corner, and didn't even put on his barn boots, because he knew he wasn't going to the barn, I guess. And he drove out the yard, and the harness traces clanging, no rhythm, no whatsoever rhythm, because the horses were going too hard, and it was cold for their lungs to go so hard. Like Grandpa Schroeder always said, Papa was not much good on horses. And Mama came out of the bedroom and picked up the Engelon costume and said, "Never mind, Elsa. Grandpa said you looked real pretty." And Elsa grabbed the costume out of her hands and scrunched it all up tight and held it to her and went to the window to strain her eyes into the night to see Papa going. And there was no moon. And that night, before Papa got home from Elmira Bittner's, Elsa took the key to the box stall and went in to Papa's white stallion. And Papa found her when he got home. And afterwards, he would not even sell the stallion. And when we moved to town a little later, because Grandpa Schroeder said so, and even bought the house, Papa kept it at Elmira Bittner's and went out from town Sundays to go to German church and ride his snow-white stallion. The words are said. The words of Elsa's dying are now said. They are in order, I think, and it does not seem too dangerous to have them down on paper. And Elsa does not speak yet, but I somehow think, now the words are all in order, if I just sit here and do not rearrange them and think very hard on Papa, that she will nod and go. Do you want to talk about a bit? What about Papa and Elsa? The relationship, the two of them, what was going on there? What had happened? What happened to it? What happened to Elsa?
She'd lost her standing in Papa's eyes She had not been able to accept this.
She worshipped him.
Right.
More details from the story on that? How had she lost her place or otherwise? What reasons?
Floydie was born. Yeah.
Also, she started looking like her mother.
Yeah. She had the Schroeder neck. She had the Schroeder neck. They were looking too much like the Schroeders. And Floydie was what? He wasn't a girl.
He was a boy.
Which he seems to emphasize at the beginning, Papa loved his son.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That whole business about three times, I think it was, that she wasn't, people will think you weren't raised, right?
Mm-hmm. And could a Schroeder raise you, right? Mm-hmm. Could a Schroeder ever raise you, right, is implied. And does Mama dress up very often?
No.
For church, she makes the effort.
And church is a frequent occasion.
Do you get how old the narrator was?
When she 50.
She's 50. This happened
41
years ago.
She was nine.
She's nine.
Got the impression she might be the oldest sister in the story.
Yeah. And there was more than one other older. There were several girls.
There's several girls. Mm-hmm. I left out a story of another sister because it didn't fit in with this particular one. But if she's the older Lucky Dowd, she says at the beginning, Papa killed his daughters 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. Does she tell you anything about her?
No. Sure.
No.
What does she tell about her?
In the steel blue eyes, there was not the feeling, touching love. It was a figurehead.
Mm. Floyd, he plays clap handies with Floyd. He's young enough to have his clothes changed on the table and cry at night and be run to. So the question could arise, is it just a baby Papa can deal with, or is it that it's a son and the girls are going to look like the mother who's not not acceptable because she's a Schroeder?
Or just that they're a girl. Just that he wait until he had a girl.
And what happens to Elsa?
She goes out to his horse. What is Papa? It's part of Papa that horse is. I took him.
Now this is you, because I think there's ambiguity there. She's dead. There's no ambiguity there.
Well, she could have chosen. You know, she just wanted to stay out there with the horse.
No, I think the horse had to have killed her because she was condemning her father for not getting rid of the horse. Remember at the end, and father kept
he kept her.
So that the horse is part of the means. All right, that's a very interesting piece of evidence that the horse killed her because Papa didn't even get rid of the white stone.
He had to take away.
And they left the farm. Well, that's, you know, the death, no matter how it happened, the grandfather wanted to leave the farm, but the horse wasn't even gotten rid of.
The horse is a means to infidelity as well as death.
Yes, because he didn't put on his shoes to go to the barn. The girls, of course, that was the narrator that realized that, maybe not Elsa, but they knew that he went other than out to the barn.
And they heard the harness going. Though they didn't hear the bells. There was no bell. She didn't hear the bells because he was going so fast. But he didn't have his barn shoes on. That's interesting. If she didn't hear, when it's a narrator telling it, if she didn't hear, did Elsa go to find her father in the barn? Is one possible. Sorry, what were you going to say?
It was curious that when the baby cried, Elsa was the one who went to him.
Why?
Like trying to win the father's favor, I think.
I'll take care of that.
Papa loves him, I don't love him.
And I'll love him too. Oh, the poor Elsa. You see the circle she's going in. I'll take on the German peace even if I can't speak it.
Maybe I can win his favor by being put to his favor.
I'm not his little angel at home anymore. I'll be an angel at the church. And does she not speak well enough? What's Papa most upset about? What hurts her the most?
Her wing droops.
Her wing droops? And she doesn't put enough zeds and ers in? She can't win. She made the costume. Why? Why didn't she let Mama make the costume?
It was big home, even it was perfect, it made it Schroeder.
She would make it, because Mama, she knows there's anger at Mama. If she makes it, then if it's good, there won't be any mixed up anger. I'll make it, and maybe Papa will see it as pure and untouched by Schroeder hands.
There's an interesting relationship between the father-in-law and the father. I assume it's animal.
His daughter, the father-in-law, I remember, wanted his daughter to go to normal school and be a teacher, you know, and she was the one that brings violets to all the neighborhood. Our time is up. I think what's here, and I'm just going to say it, and if you want to see me more, that what here is family relationships going on, and I don't have to say more. If you've got things you've seen or know or feel or imagine or want to invent, the first step is getting it out. You know, last week we started right away trying to put it in fiction. And what I discovered is that people getting it out in diary or journal or a fictional voice, a lot of people pretending to be someone other than they weren't, but it gets it out. If you've got stuff you want to write, give it to me anytime and I'll go through it and give it back to you this week.